This is Point of Inquiry for Friday, April 21st, 2006.
Welcome to Point of Inquiry. I'm DJ Grothy. Point of Inquiry is the radio show and podcast of the Center for Inquiry, a think tank collaborating with the State University of New York at Buffalo on the new Science and the Public master's degree. CFI also has branches in Manhattan, Tampa, and Hollywood, and 11 cities around the world. Each week on Point of Inquiry, we look at some of the most basic assumptions of our society, focusing on three research areas. First, there's pseudoscience and the paranormal. Second, alternative medicine. Third, we look at secularism, religion, and science, and how they intersect. We do this by drawing on the Center for Inquiry's relationship with the leading minds of the day, including Nobel Prize-winning scientists, public intellectuals, social critics and thinkers, and renowned entertainers. On today's episode of Point of Inquiry, I talk with Bill Nye, who introduced a whole generation of students to science and the wonders of science, and I talk with him about the implications of science for some of the most important problems facing our world today. But first, Point of Inquiry contributor Lauren Becker asks, have you been saved? It's Earth Day.
Have you been saved? As an atheist, I'm never really quite sure how to respond to this. From what is the answer that usually comes to mind. As an environmentalist, however, I've learned this question takes on an entirely different meaning. This Saturday, April 22nd, is the 36th anniversary of Earth Day. This worldwide event, along with Monday Night Football, Apollo 13, and me, it turns out, was born in 1970. A U.S. senator from Wisconsin named Gaylord Nelson decided to organize a kind of environmental protest, an attempt, in his words, to shake up the political establishment and force the issue onto the national agenda. Earth Day became the first in a new series of campaigns to save the whales, save the trees, or just plain save the Earth. Since then, we've made some good progress, but after three decades of hard work, we seem to have reached an impasse. In many areas, we're actually losing ground. The problem, I think, isn't the movement. I think it's the message. All this time, we haven't really been honest with ourselves or the public, and it's allowed us to make some bad decisions. Now, if we hope to succeed, we have to admit the truth. The environmental movement is not about saving the Earth. First of all, just listen to that phrase, save the Earth. Who are we kidding? The Earth is an enormous mass of inorganic material, 8,000 miles thick, with just the thinnest margin of life clinging to its surface. It's a giant rock. It's been here for 5 billion years, and it will be here another 5 billion years, whether we recycle those bottles or not. The Earth doesn't need our saving. It doesn't even know we exist. Far from saving it, we could do everything in our power to try to destroy it, and 10 million years later, it would still be here, a big rock orbiting a much bigger star, with no evidence that we ever existed. No, the environmental movement isn't about saving the Earth. It's not about saving the whales, the trees, the baby seals, the coral reefs, the wild salmon, the spotted owl, or even the air and water. What we so desperately need to understand, what we must internalize until it's part of our very being, part of our every action and decision, is this. The environmental movement is about saving the humans. It's about saving us, you, me, and our kids. We humans like to think that we are special and unique, set apart from the world and in charge of its stewardship. But we can no longer afford such fantastic dreams. It might be fun to feel like some sort of magnanimous benefactor doing our part to save the poor little planet, but this is a disastrous misunderestimating of the situation. In truth, we aren't special creations, and we are most certainly not set apart. We are animals, barely different from the other mammals of the world. We are made of the earth, of the same elements that make the trees, the whales, the spotted owl, and we rely on that same air and water that they do. Like them, we do the best we can to make do with our surroundings, to survive long enough to produce offspring. Problem is, we've gotten so good at producing those offspring, we've accidentally created the perfect conditions to kill them. There are over 6 billion people on the planet right now. If present trends continue, that will double to 12 billion in the next 40 years. How old are you? Will you still be around in 40 years? Try to imagine 12 billion people. Now, of course, you're thinking that could never happen. And you're right. There is no way the living systems of the Earth can support 12 billion human beings. Phew. But if it's nice to think we won't have to share the world with 12 billion of our cousins, we would be better served if we remember exactly what, ultimately, will save us from such overcrowding. It's called famine, drought, disease, pestilence, and war. It's a veritable hell of biblical proportions, but these disasters would not be the result of a jealous God. They would be the result of ignorant animals, too consumed with consumption to realize they were killing their own children. It's more pleasant to think we're being generous and giving of ourselves to save the earth, that thing separate from us. But it entirely misses the point and dooms us to failure. The earth is not dependent on our generosity. Have you forgotten? It's a rock. It needs nothing from us. Without it, however, we are nothing. We need to save the earth. We need to save the forests and the oceans and the air. But it's time to stop messing around. Earth Day isn't about philanthropy. We don't save these things for their sake. We save them for ours. We must work to save ourselves. So the next time someone asks you, have you been saved? Think a little deeper. Think like an environmentalist and respond, I'm doing everything I can. Then get to work. Happy Human Day, everyone.
Hi, I'm Barry Carr, Executive Director of PSYCOP here at the Center for Inquiry. We're celebrating our 30th anniversary this year, making the world safe for science and skepticism, and dealing with fringe science and paranormal claims. We publish what I think is an essential magazine, The Skeptical Inquirer. This is the magazine for science and reason. The March-April issue is now on the bookshelves and can be ordered online at www.psycop.org. Or by calling our toll-free number, 1-800-634-1610. Subscribing to the Skeptical Inquirer helps us continue to advance science and reason in our society. And I'm so sure that you'll love this magazine that I want you to have a complimentary issue to see what we're all about. To get your sample copy of the Skeptical Inquirer, just call 1-800-634-1610 and mention the Point of Inquiry podcast and ask us for your free copy. We'll get it right out to you and you can begin enjoying the Skeptical Inquirer. Thank you.
Many of our listeners may be familiar with our next guest. Bill Nye, formerly Bill Nye the Science Guy, a show that won 28 Emmys, is famous for his contagious passion for science that's made him a TV star and one of America's leading popularizers of the scientific outlook. His new show, focusing on the wonderful world of science, called The Eyes of Nye, can be seen nationwide. Nye is a fellow of PSYCOP, the Committee for the Scientific Investigation of Claims of the Paranormal, and a longtime advocate of the public understanding of science. He's the author of many books on science for children, some of which can be found at a discount on our website, pointofinquiry.org. Bill, welcome to the show.
It's so good to be here.
Bill, let's begin by asking you, why should people learn about science in the first place?
It's how we understand the world. And if you are like me, and I know I am, I'm concerned about the future. We have global climate change. We have 6 billion people going on 10 billion people, 12 billion people living on what's proving to be a very small planet. We have acquired immune deficiency syndrome. We have malaria moving north and south. We got problems. And these are all science problems. Then we're speaking English. I'm in the United States. And if you're a bit of a patriot, as a citizen of the United States or Canada, you would be concerned about global competition from China and India. So science is the key to all of these problems, or is at the heart of all of these problems. So science is more important than ever.
So you're interested in the implications of science for some of society's most pressing problems. Your earlier shows seem to be just about the fascination, the beauty of science. Your earlier show, Bill Nye the Science Guy, which introduced a whole generation of children to science and why it was fun and interesting, your shows were not only heavy on science, having a robust science content, but they were really funny and entertaining. Before we get into the more pressing concerns that you just mentioned, I'm curious about a couple other things. How did you end up making science, which is sometimes seen to be stuffy and only for people in lab coats, and comedy, how did you make those things go so well together for children?
What I say is science and humor are both human endeavors. So, of course you would combine them. What's funnier than lighting the fuse and nothing happens? You're laughing just thinking about it. So, to me, combining them was very natural. That's all I can tell you. I've loved science since I was a little kid. My parents, my older brother and sister are both very funny. And we were brought up with humor. Humor was just part of your everyday life. So when if you're going to make a TV show that's going to be entertaining, in my family, one would pretty much presume it would be funny.
When you were studying at Cornell originally, you took an astronomy course from Carl Sagan. Carl Sagan was concerned as a scientist in many of the things about which you mentioned a question ago, the implications of science for some of the world's most pressing problems. What kind of influence did that course with Carl Sagan have on your career?
Well, astronomers, and especially Carl Sagan, have what I like to call a planetary point of view. And he emphasized that a lot. He was one of the pioneers of the concept of nuclear winter, where human activity could change the climate of an entire planet. And this is, to me, closely related to the idea of climate change, of global heating. People call it global warming. I just call it global heating. Warming sounds happy and nice. Heating is dangerous, hot, burning, cooking, irreversible. So this planetary perspective, which is an astronomer's perspective, I really feel I got from Carl Sagan.
In your new show, you've moved more seriously into science advocacy and science popularization. This new show, The Eyes of Nye, seems a bit different than the show you did for children's education. You're planning on tackling more grown-up and controversial subjects, such as you mentioned, global warming, but you've also treated addiction, cloning. I'm wondering, are you also going to look at other issues like alien abduction and stigmata, faith healing, even what science may say about science and religion or some of the other really pressing questions of the day?
Yes. We did do a show on pseudoscience, and pseudoscience to me would include stigmata and psychics. We had a skeptic on, and he did some cold readings. He did palm reading, tarot cards, and a horoscope. And people believed him. They thought he had psychic ability. But then he would say at the end of the interview, I don't. And this is very important for all of us to understand how easy it is to get duped or to believe in something that's scientifically not true. And I remind everybody that science is a human endeavor. It's not something, pun intended, alien to the human experience. The same human that might fool him or herself into believing in a psychic is capable of understanding the process of science, critical thinking, and disciplined inquiry. So this is great work that I think needs to be done. And as far as religion goes, religion is really a matter of faith. If you want to believe in something, knock yourself out. But we can't go putting a religious faith-based view of the origin of the planet Earth and the origin of life on Earth in place of scientific knowledge in science class. It's not, I mean, it's really easy to dismiss it, say, oh, it's not science, but it isn't. It's got nothing to do with science. It's philosophy or something. So we just need to keep them separate.
I heard recently that your favorite subject used to be, am I right, physics, but now it's evolutionary biology. Why the change?
Well, one thing led to another. I was brought up with physics. I was brought up with bicycles and airplanes and the United States Space Program. And I love physics. But with that said, these discoveries associated with evolution are making it's making it clear that evolution is the fundamental idea in all of life science, in all of biology. Physicists would give their eye teeth to have a theory of everything. Well, in biology, we kind of do. Evolution is the theory of everything. It explains so much of the way animals and plants, microorganisms interact, and so much, frankly, of the human experience, of why we feel the way we do. Fascinating.
Are you finding that your appreciation of and advocacy for the scientific outlook when it comes to the theory of evolution, let's say, is that more controversial for you? Is that harder for you to find an audience for? Does it get people's ires up more?
Well, it's not hard to find an audience. People love to argue about it. But yeah, I've had people express concern. And in general, people who have a fundamentalist view of religion, specifically a fundamentalist view of the Old Testament in the Bible as written in English, are upset or concerned when you point out that the Earth is more than 6,000 years old. Here's how we know. And we almost all, every living thing on Earth almost certainly has a single common ancestor. It's, some people are upset by that. I'm excited and charmed and full of wonder and reverence, frankly. And other people take it as a personal attack. We as a society, have to work this out. But it's going to be a long time before I accept a fundamentalist interpretation of the Bible as written in English as a substitute for example, radiometric dating of ancient rock.
I heard a story of your recent talk, a talk you gave in Waco, Texas, where there were, I think I heard there were protests because, among other things, you made the statement that the moon reflects the light of the sun, but according to the Bible, the moon emits its own light. One woman reportedly walked out of your talk saying that the Bible contradicted that notion, that the Bible, she believed, said the moon emits its own light. She walked out. She was upset. How do you react to things like that?
Well, one person walked out. There weren't really protests. And the story is more like this. I showed a quotation from the Bible as written in modern English, where in the book of Genesis, verse 16, right at the first page of the Bible, there's a discussion, they point out, whoever wrote it points out that God made one light to shine by day and the other lesser light to shine at night. Then he made all the stars also. That's sort of what it says. It's like, my question for the audience is, did the person who wrote that really know that the sun is this thermonuclear thing giving off its own light, and the moon is lit by that same sun? It just doesn't look like the Bible, whoever wrote the Bible, has that fundamental knowledge. Looks like he or she thought they both glowed, and there's no more to it. Furthermore, he also made all the stars. Oh yeah, the billions and billions of stars. Most of the universe is dismissed in the Bible in three or four English words. Like, wow. It's sort of, it is, if I may, irreverent. It's not, to me, not very compelling. It strikes me as written by somebody who was not moved by the beauty and wonder of the universe. And so some woman got upset without, I don't think, with all due respect, without thinking about it.
So I'm not trying to read into what you're saying, but it appears that you're talking about there being a possible conflict between the scientific outlook and a fundamentalist view and an inerrantist, kind of a literalist way of looking at a holy text.
Yeah, well, the word holy, I mean, is another human idea. Certainly, I mean, if you want me to believe that the Earth is 6,000 years old based on these English words on the first page of the Bible, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to go along with it. I think you're squandering your intellect. And to put it in traditional terms, you're wasting your God-given ability to think, if you want to put it that way. And so this would all be fine. It wouldn't matter if we didn't have global heating, if the world weren't sort of going to end for many, many humans unless we take a scientifically literate view and take scientifically informed steps to save the planet for our own species. You know, the Earth's going to be fine, no matter what humans do. The Earth will be here. I want to save the Earth for me. I want it so humans can live here. And to go around ignoring all that we have learned through the centuries of scientific inquiry and try to substitute it for the literal interpretation of the Bible as written in English, I mean, with all due respect, I got no time for you. I mean, you're a problem. So this is, so I pointed that out.
When you look at America and the overwhelming number of people who believe that the Earth is 6,000 years old and that the Bible is written and holy writ by one God in 6,000 years handed down, you know, I don't want to turn this into a debate between science and religion, but it sounds like some of the claims you're making are very, very unpopular. Have you had any of that unpopular response with your position?
Not really. I mean, most people are very supportive. And, for example, in Waco, Texas, it's in the Bible Belt, so-called. There's a lot of fundamentalists, or more fundamentalists than you would find in many other places in the world. But it's also a college town, so people were very supportive. They're very thoughtful. And I'm not going to back down from what I believe, or I'm not going to back down from my goal to change the world by promoting scientific literacy on account of a few people who don't want to think for themselves, or kind of a few people who want to interpret the Bible as written in English literally in place of science. It's not acceptable to me. I mean, I defy any of these people to go to a place like Dinosaur National Monument and look at the hillside full of dinosaur fossil bones and tell me that the Earth is 6,000 years old. I don't think they've ever done it. I mean, you could tell you wouldn't be thinking for yourself if you went there and tried to stick to that gun.
What is one topic in science, or that science has something to say about, that we should all be very worried about? In other words, you seem kind of radicalized by science, the implications of science for some of the most important questions facing us. What's something we should all be very worried about right now?
Well, global climate change, global heating. It will change the world in ways that are very, very hard to recover from. So we have 6 billion people going on 7, 8, 10, 15 billion people. If everybody were to live the way we live, for example, in the United States, we will need 2 more Earths. We can't get those Earths. They're not available. So we have to change the way we live, and I would much rather do it in a controlled fashion where we live less inefficiently, get along better, rather than having catastrophes that starve people to death by the billions. I would just rather not go that way. And you use the expression radicalized by science. I don't think I'm a radical at all compared to most scientists. I just, because of the popularity of the old show, I'm able to speak my mind in public forum. But it's not my point of view compared with other scientists. With all due, ain't no big deal.
In fact, it's pretty consensus, wouldn't you say, among most scientists?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, this is the thing about this weird religious fundamentalism that we have in what was once the world's most technologically advanced society, the United States. All scientists share my point of view, or I share the point of view of all scientists. There's this weird thing now where people are interpreting this debate as a fairness issue, but somehow it wouldn't be fair to religious people to teach science in science class. Instead, you want to teach fundamentalism of the Bible written in English in place of science. That's not acceptable. If you want to teach fundamentalism as written in English in philosophy class or study it in a comparative literature class, very appropriate. It should be done. But my point of view is not really radical with regard to science. It's just that we're getting this polarization, and I would claim that the polarization is being brought on by the fundamentalists as a way to get more people to their cause. You have to pick one or the other. Very inappropriate.
But surely you're more activist about it than a lot of scientists. A lot of scientists, maybe because they lack your fame, your public face, they're just busy doing their own things and they're not speaking out. Would you be so bold as to call on other scientists to be more vocal about these sorts of issues?
Well, whenever scientists are called on, I think they're pretty vocal. But there's been a weird thing the last few months where the current federal administration is suppressing, for example, the use of the expression climate change. They're editing, they're censoring what professional scientists are saying, federal government, people who work for the federal government are saying. Very inappropriate. It's in no one's best interest. It will, dare I say it, kill us all. Now, bear in mind that I don't have a full-time research job. I'm a performer. I'm a television personality, and that's how I make my living. So I make my living being on television, whereas other scientists make their living doing science. So it seems like I'm higher profile, but I don't think I'm any more passionate than most scientists. Most scientists you speak with are very passionate, very concerned about the current state of sort of scientific perception of science among the U.S. public right now.
Let me ask you lastly, do you think that science or the public understanding and appreciation of science, is it winning ground or losing ground? I guess what I'm asking is, do you see much light at the end of the tunnel, or is it just, are the Armageddonists right? Is the world going to hell in a handbasket?
Well, things are getting worse. And to people who want to reject science, don't want to embrace it, just I remind you, you should have your kid pursue it. Because the future is going to be for scientists and engineers. And if no other reason, because China and India will, without saying it out loud, bury us unless we reinvigorate our science education. This is not a controversial point of view. I mean, everybody knows it, just like no one's around to do anything about it. So this is my message. We have to, dare I say it, change the world. Right now, we're losing ground. But we'll see. As this administration continues to be so fraught with problems, maybe they'll lose credibility and people will get back on a scientific path. That is certainly what I'm working towards. We are trying to change the world.
Bill Nye, thank you very much for being on the show.
Thank you.
You've seen the headlines. Paranormal goes primetime. Vatican hosts conference on intelligent design. More clinics to offer alternative medicine. Christian fundamentalism drives U.S. extremism. These stories sum up the immense challenge facing those of us who defend rational thinking, science, and secular values, what one advisor to the Bush administration dismissed as the reality-based community. Who could have imagined that reality would need defenders? The educational and advocacy work of the Center for Inquiry is more essential than ever, and your support is more essential than ever. Show your commitment to science, reason, and secular values by becoming a friend of the Center today. Whether you are interested in the work of PsyCop and Skeptical Inquirer magazine, the Council for Secular Humanism and Free Inquiry magazine, the Commission for Scientific Medicine, or Center for Inquiry on Campus, by becoming a friend of the Center, you'll help strengthen our impact. If you are just learning about CFI, take a look at our website, www.centerforinquiry.net. We host regional and international conferences, offer college courses, and conduct nationwide campus outreach. On our website, you'll also find information regarding our new representation at the United Nations and important national media appearances. We could not pursue these projects without your support. Please become a friend of the Center today by calling 1-800-818-7071 or visiting www.centerforinquiry.net. We look forward to working with you to expand our reality-based community.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Point of Inquiry. Join us next week for a discussion with Dr. Eugenie Scott about science and religion and about the current ID versus evolution controversies. To get involved with an online conversation about today's discussion I had with Bill Nye, go to www.cfi-forums.org. Views expressed on Point of Inquiry don't necessarily reflect the views of the Center for Inquiry nor its affiliated organizations. Questions and comments on today's show can be sent to feedback@pointofinquiry.org or by visiting our website at pointofinquiry.org. Point of Inquiry is produced by Thomas Donnelly and recorded at the Center for Inquiry in Amherst, New York. Executive producer is Paul Kurtz. Point of Inquiry's music is written and composed for us by Emmy Award-winning Michael Whalen. Contributors today include Barry Carr, Lauren Becker, and Sarah Jordan. I'm your host, DJ Grothy.